Station number 11206, Reel 11.
Mr. T. Thornthwaite, Reel 11.
Wheel type of a weapon. It was a weapon
that yes, was meant to damage them. It was to damage the troops if they were attacking the position. And as I said, it was about 4 foot and down, about 4 foot wide and about 4 to 5 foot in diameter, a massive thing. And there was rockets and all kinds on it and explosions. And the idea was to just go through the infantry attacking and you know, damage them. Of course, we didn't know at the time what it was. We said it was a flaming kitchen, as called it. But afterwards, we found, when we moved out into it, we found out what it actually was. Now, we had a very similar system. We had a cable, a hawser affair, right round our positions in the front. And every 50 feet, there was like a rocket all the way around. And now this was about a foot and a half from the ground, supporter on pegs or something. And the idea being, if the Germans had attacked during the night or during the day, they electrically could start this thing off. And you can imagine this hawser with the rockets going about a foot and a half from the ground forward. It would just chop the infantry by the legs, just shoot them all. That was one of the things that we had. So they were both the same on both sides. Let's say we got into this plonk, and there was firing and going and all the rest of it. The platoon forward, this young lieutenant, he was about 50 feet in front of us. When we got through, he went straight forward, and our job was one platoon went left when it got through Jerry Way, one went right. The idea, and then go forward and occupy this position where Jerry was. But we got so far and we couldn't get any further. People were being hit, so we had to lie down. We laid down, and I never felt so exposed in all my life when they were firing these parachute mines. They fire them, and it hung above you, and it just, not mines, parachute flares. And it above you, and it just slowly come down, and it was like broad daylight, and you were lying there. But I don't know, Jerry didn't fire on us when we were lying there for some reason, whether he couldn't see us from his position or what. But the people on the left platoon, this Cowell, I always remember, he was on one knee and he was firing this Tommy gun.
What did they call this chap?
Cowell.
Cowell.
He was firing this Tommy gun forward. And amongst the noise and shouting, I remember I trying to tell him that there was our platoon was in front of us. Sergeant Giles, a sergeant, was in this front platoon in front of us. And this chap was firing the Tommy gun in their direction. Then he got hit, so he fell down. Anyway, we eventually had to get out. Vaux, Major Vaux is lying there. The captain was near him. And I remember him saying to this captain, "We can't go any further forward. We'll have to get out," something like that. And then everybody just up, and there was a mad rush. Everybody rushing to get out of this doings and get out and get into our wire. Well, I got so far, got through the wire, our wire, jumped. I took a flying jump at it, and I landed in the middle when I managed to get out. I got so far, and I found this Sergeant Giles. And he never swore in his life. He used to be known as Flipper. He'd say, "Flipping thing, flipping that." And he was swearing like a blooming trooper. He says, "I've been shot in the arse." So we picked them up and we carried them, and we carried them all the way back to our position. And when they did get him to the hospital, they found it was a Tommy gun. But he'd been shot by the other people shooting forward into that platoon. So this lieutenant, I remember, he stuck his took a bayonet and stuck her in the doings on the wire where we were to give us some position how far we got forward if we ever went back there and dealing. And we came back to move back. They had searchlights shining to give directions which to come back to the position within our wire. And it was just a right failure. We never took the position at all, and Jerry held that all the time we're in Tobruk. We lost a few blokes. I seen one bloke on the wire. He'd been hit on the wire, and you know he couldn't get out. Another lad, Pereira, corporal, he tried to crawl under the wire. When he crawled under about four, and he got himself all entangled with everything. But they got them all away and went to hospital, and them that was taken, some taken prisoner. So that was one of the attacks that we did out at Tobruk and for the battalion.
What are your reactions after the attack is over and you're back? What is the usual type of reaction to it all?
Well, you were drained. You know, you had no energy, whatever, because your adrenaline must be going mad, you know, during the night with all this, all the going on. And unfortunately, with it not being a success, you weren't as boisterous as you could have been, you know. But
did you witness any men who broke under this kind of
action? Oh, yes. There was blokes running back, even when we're going in under the shelling. This Feet Nicholson, I always remember him putting his hands out. We're going forward and they were coming back, and he's putting his hands out and he's saying, "Get back, you know, get up," and all the rest of it. Because I think it... well, I mean, they'd been in Capuzzo and all the rest of it. They'd been in action, so... But it's so at night time, you don't know what's happening. You know, the shelling and noise and everything. And I suppose everybody suspect everybody else is leaving them and leaving them.
Does this have its effects upon men who are going forward? Does it have any adverse effects?
Well, it depends on the leaders. I mean, the leaders keep on going. The rest of them always follow them. But once there's a hesitation, then the panic sets in. But there was not a lot. I mean, it was only a few that was doing this. Oh, the majority was just do as they were told. Yeah.
Can we go back to the positions you were holding? You've mentioned patrols that you were on and other duty and the duty of going back to the company for the password and so on. What were the type of duties that were going on during the day? Were there some other duties that were going on actually within the position?
No, there was nothing going on during the day. That story I read for the fellowship, it explained it. I mean... It was early morning and everybody was returned and night patrols had come back and everybody settled down and they were in their dugouts and they slept. And then it all started again at night again. You know?
It sounds very much like a First World War kind of
situation. Oh, it was. That Tobruk was a front line, you know, an actual front line. And I mean, in Normandy there was no such thing as front line, but that was a typical 1914 war. You got mortared, you got shelled. He went out nights amongst jerry wire, and I mean, it was going on all the time. But the surprising thing, the Germans never did this. They never sent patrols into our wire, never. So, I don't know why, but we were always keeping them awake, and of course it kept us awake as well, but kept them on their toes. We had these poles I told you about. They could go with us on a patrol and then they'd leave us when we come to German wire, and they'd go through the wire and they'd take up positions behind the German, half a mile behind the front line, and they lay there and they watch everything, and they even mix with the Germans because they could speak German and everything. And then they'd come back and report much more than we could have done on a dome.
Can we talk about weapons for a while, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Yeah.
Were there any weapons in the time that you were in Tobruk, in the Tobruk area, were there any weapons on from the German side which you came to recognise as
well?
Especially
in our positions, in the dugouts facing, We put more faith in the enemy's weapons than what we did our own. And we only had the brain. We didn't have the MGs. The MGs then was no longer in the infantry. The Northumberland Fusiliers in Tobruk, they were the machine gun battalion. So we didn't have the MGs then. We had a brain gun and rifles, which is hopeless for a position like that. And the sand used to block them and stop them. So what we had from the Australians, we had Spanders, we had loads of ammunition, and we had breeders, the Italian breeders.
Were these captured weapons?
Yeah, captured from them. And they were our defence, weapons. We didn't use our brains and put them away. And then had the stupid Boyd anti-tank rifle, which when we captured German positions, they had them to keep the roof up. That's as much faith they had them. But I remember the breeder, we couldn't get the thing to work, and somebody said there was an Italian prisoners further back there, and so we went down, got one, and brought them up. And I remember he saying, "Oilio, oilio," and he poured oil in the thing, and it fired away. But he was covered in oil, mind, but it was probably the enemy would have died with dermatitis or something, the amount of oil. But we used oil, and Mills grenades, used to put a lot of faith in those. Used to have them lying around. And I mean, when the sun was belting down, it used to be red hot during the day in them places. Especially when you're outside, inside it was a bit cooler. One of the pleasures, I think, was tea. You know, the ration of tea. It was very rationed, but used to look forward to that more than anything. And of course, I know that I mentioned that the cigarette issue in Cairo was Victory V's, and nobody chucked them away. They wouldn't have them. And I just stuck them in my kid bag. Of course, when we went to Tobruk, here they were sitting with a kid bag of Victory V's, and nobody else had a cigarette. I was the most popular bloke in the battalion. And then after they'd finished, it's a peculiar thing. When you finished, you didn't worry about smoking because you knew you couldn't get any. So you just forgot all about it, and you got over it. We used to cut each other's hair with an ordinary fork and a razor blade, you know, chuffing little tufts, because we never got bass or nothing like that. I once sacrificed some water. I had my mess tin, and I had this tin of butter the Australians left. It was full of sand, but I used to put a matchstick or something in it, and put me Dixie over her water in, and it took about half a day to heat up. But I actually started with a hanky I had to try and have a bit of a bath. And then somebody said, "Leave it and I'll have one." I mean, about three blokes, you can imagine, a half a pint of water, the state it was in. But the fleas, as soon as you're in your dugout, as soon as you got warm at night, the fleas all around the seams of your shirts, and the whole lot used to be moving, you know.
You had trouble with louse.
Yeah, they're covered in them.
Was there a lot of desert flies around you for eating times particularly?
There was flies, but I didn't see so many, surprisingly enough. You had your kangaroo rats. I ate one, actually, but I didn't know it. We went out on a daylight patrol. It was very rare. And we were trying to because there'd been some advance by the South African army outside Tobruk, but we were still surrounded. But there was a salient near us, and we had to go out and go to this place to see whether it was occupied or not. And we were moving in an open extended road across the desert, and this blooming aircraft came down. And of course, we had nowhere to go, no devotion, nothing, even expo, but it was one of ours. Anyway, there's this furry thing shot forward in front of us, and all the rifles came up, and there was a fur flying all over. And we found it was what we thought was a hare. So we took it back when we come back to our positions, and we got this platoon cook to cook it, and he put it in a tin with the hare, with the fur and a lot on. He just cooked it. Then we found out afterwards it was very bitter. That it was a rat, kangaroo rat with it. We didn't know. Just,
Were you under any enemy air attack yourselves? I know the port was bombed, obviously.
The what?
Were you under any enemy air attacks?
Oh, yes, we used to, in the front positions, in the front line, we used to get Stuka. Stuka, it was terrible because we had no air force. The last fighter pilot or air fighter they had in Tobruk, the Australian shot them down in sympathy, from what I heard, because he used to go up against all odds. That was the last there was in Tobruk. There was an airdrome there, but there was no aircraft. And you'd be on your frontline positions. I remember the last time I seen it, was some, we were in 300 yards behind the front line, and we're seeing these Stukas come over, because the Latham was only just over, it wasn't a couple of miles away, a Latham area, and you could hear Jerry Turn taken off. And they'd come round and they'd circle, you'd see vultures circling around somewhere where there's something dying. And they used to do that, and above the position. And then they'd start diving down, straight down, and bomb the front line positions. And the only time the Boyd's hunting rifle come in any use was there. They used to use it as an anti-aircraft thing. I know it was only one shot, but it was much better than your brains and things like that against the Stuka.
What was it like being bombed by Stukas?
Well, you just bombed. You couldn't do nothing. You just sat in gloom and terror and waited until it finished. And then when all the dust and everything cleared, you thought everybody had been killed. And surprisingly enough, most used to get up. I don't know. But they used to screaming down. And the thing is, you couldn't do nothing. And there was no... And then as the South Africans were moving up, because we didn't know what was happening outside Tobruk. We had little knowledge and news of it. We're in sitting on our side of a position. It was dusk, just before dark. And we heard this drone of planes. And we looked over, and the sky was black with aircraft. We thought, God, we'll be bombed with smithereens here. And they came over Tobruk like that. Because they were pretty good height. And then they all wheeled over, and there were hours of bombed a lot of aerodrome. Now you should have heard the cheers going up from Tobruk. They went cheers like mad.
You changed positions, you said, from the concrete positions.
Yeah.
You moved to another area. Where was that?
Well, we moved from the salient. If you can imagine a semicircle with a sea behind you, and we were on the right hand side, that was a salient. Now, the road from Laddam was in the centre to Tobruk. Well, we moved from the salient and we moved right away over to the left hand side. Now, that wasn't concrete, it was just ordinary, like 1914 war dugouts, dug in the earth and sandbags over the top and things like that.
And were these rooms and things dug into the
earth? Oh, no. All you had was. You had just like if you imagine 1914 war, you had a trench about 4 foot, 5 foot deep. And then into the side, you had an individual dugout where you slept. And that was your doings. And you were on in the dugout. And we didn't know, but the idea was why we moved in. This is when we broke out of Tobruk. See, that's why we brought over that.
So this
same.
Must have been towards
That'll be getting in the November, back end of November. Into December, actually. It was in December then when we were moving there. Because when we moved there, we were in reserve. Some unit had broke out, made a corridor. But it wasn't held. It didn't join up with the forces coming up the Western Desert. It was just a corridor, and then there was like another front line that hadn't got through. Now, remember the 4th Tank Corps, the 4th Tank Regiment, that was it. They were in Tobruk with us. What was left of when they were enclosed in Tobruk when the first Tobruk. And they had the 2-pound anti-tank rifle on the front. The anti-tank gun, and it was disgraceful. I remember this one came back, and a Jerry 88 had hit the front of the gun, and it just splined open, and you had the barrel split. The barrel was only about that down, and it was cut open, and all crinkled up like that. I mean, Jerry could shell and knock the tanks out long before they ever got near the 88, and they had no chance whatever.
Yeah. The dugout positions, which you said were like First World War trenches, what did you have in front of the dugout positions in this area?
The wire. You had your main wire, just the same.
Did you have an anti-tank ditch?
Yeah. Yes, well, that went right away round from one side to Brook to the other. That was continuous. That would be dug by the Italians, when they were, in the early days of Tobruk.
Did you ever go into a rest position, and taken away from the front line?
Yes. Now, what was it? We came back into the centre to Brook. I can't remember. Oh, yeah, I remember. We came back from the front line to centre to Brook. Now, in this area, there was hundreds of trucks, about 100 yards apart, all over this bit of desert. They were trucks that was left from when the first Tobruk was formed, when they were in turn. I went there and were told to pick a truck, three or four of you. And this is what they were. They were sleeping accommodation for people coming down from the front line. And of course, they were scattered all over. So Jerry used to come on shelling and bombing. I mean, around them. I always remember we'd been there 2 days and had us out and had us clean the equipment and all kinds. We thought, typical Durrans, we're only 2 minutes out the front line and we're cleaning equipment.
Did you get opportunities for bathing?
No. We weren't down near the sea. No, this was internal. And then
was there any things like battalion baths? Or?
No, nothing like that. Nothing at all. All there was is you were filthy, you got used to being filthy, and you just slept in the trucks in amongst all the sand. I mean, these things had been lying there for blooming, I don't know, 12 months or something, with sandstorms, and they'd been shelled and everything, and you just made yourself as comfortable as possible. And then after a couple of days, then we moved up to this corridor I mentioned. We marched, that was it. Because I remember we come to this, it getting dusk, we come to it, and big signs up, in shelling area, where this is, Jerry could see this, and he'd shell you as you move. So our job, we move through there, and then we turn right, up onto the escarpment. And our job, we did this attack, 176.176, I think they called it. If you remember, we were facing the German, and the Germans are up on an escarpment facing us. When they broke out this corridor, they come to the left of this escarpment, and our battalion had to go in and go up onto the escarpment, and then Jerry was all dug in, and our Italians all dug in there, which they were overlooking Tobruk. And our job was to attack there and take these positions. And it was going towards a lot of my aerodrome. It was at night time. We had tanks. But our CO, Ardine, says, I don't want the tanks to go in with us. He says, because if they do, Jerry will know we're coming in, all the rest of it. But he still knew in any case. And the battalion moved in, and we took this position from the Italians. And as we moved in, we got shelled all the way, and when we got into it, you could hear vehicles starting up. And when we got there, we captured, there's all these Italians. And the gunners were standing near their guns that had been shelling us all the way in. And they were standing there, they had their hands up, and their little cases back next to them. And they're all ready to be taken prisoner of war. And some of our blokes wasn't too pleased with it, because they shelled them all the way. I remember we had an officer, Keith, I think he was a Lieutenant Keith. He was a signals officer in the battalion during the attack, and he had haversacks full of signalling, vary lights and all the rest of it, because there was, as we moved forward, a successful area. As you'd fire these to indicate the CO what was happening and how far we're getting in. Well, unfortunately, he got hit with one of these Italian phosphorus grenade things. And he was just in front, and he got hit. And then all this stuff he was carrying all took fire, you know, and he died. It was such a shame, because he was such a nice officer, Keith. And we took up, got into positions. I was this captain, Sanderson. I keep on saying San, I don't know if that's his name, but he collared me and somebody else. He says, come with me. And of course, it's still pitch dark. And here's an Italian with, in those days, and we haven't heard about Jeeps, but it was very similar to a Jeep. It was a small vehicle like that, and the wheels were about 6 foot in diameter, four wheels, and it's peculiar, the thing could run over, each wheel is independent sprung. You could just go across slip trenches and everything with it. And he says, right, you two get in the back. And he sat in the front with the Italian driver. The Italian couldn't speak English because he was now a prisoner. And he said to the Italian, if you want to go this way, say Cairo. If you want to go that way, say Aladdin. So he says, Aladdin. And we were flying along this tarmacanic road, well in front of our battalion, already dug in now in the positions. And we didn't know where we thought we were going to Aladdin Airport. And eventually he decided he'd gone far enough and never come across any Jerry. Because Jerry, all them vehicles we heard, was Jerry leaving the Italians in the position and scarpering away, left them. We came back and he reported that there didn't appear to be anybody in front near front of positions. So we took positions in the little sangas and that the Italians had had. We got rations and that. And we found in the dugouts, we found writing paper. In the German positions, we found this malt loaf. Well, after biscuits, bully biff, it was from a treat. The malt loaf was wrapped in like a tin foil and then paper. And when you opened it, you just think it had just been made. It was beautiful stuff. And during this attack, I forgot to mention, we had to go through this salient, through this wadi, and we passed through the Northumberland Fusiliers. They were dug in there, and we passed through them to go into where we were going to attack. And of course, you can imagine the Durhams in the middle of the desert missing the Northumberland Fusiliers. Everybody stopped and they were talking, and the Northumberlands had 50-gallon barrels of blooming vino, tins, drums, and they were giving us pine pots full of it and everything. And the battalion came to a halt. And they were flying around the officers to get it moving again away from the Northumberlands. And the Northumberlands had been playing cards with each other for months in their positions. And they owed each other millions of blooming pounds. Very, we moved through. And as I say, we took up the positions and where we were in front of them. And we were there 24 hours. And I remember somebody, a day after, happened to walk down the side of this wadi, and he seen a cave, and he went in, and it was a massive, and there were 60 Italians in there, still in there, waiting to be taken prisoner, and brought them out, and then from there, we moved out of there, and we got trucks, and we moved through the New Zealand division. The New Zealand division was on the other side of the corridor where we broke out. And we moved through them, and then we're on our way down the desert. And I remember at night we stopped outside Bardia. Oh no, before that, we watched the Scottish battalion going into action. We were up a height, and we were looking down on what we were defending Tobruk before. We're looking down. And we watched a daylight attack by a brigade of the Scotch. And they were moving forward to these positions. And fortunately for them, they were unoccupied. So it was no about casualties. And we moved back through the New Zealanders and on the way to Bardia. At Bardia, we had to dig in and get under the trucks because we could be shelled, still be shelled there. And they said that the I think it was the New Zealanders were going in to take Bardia. And I mean, that was further down towards Alex, for all we got Tobruk. And they went in and took Tobruk. It took Bardia, captured Bardia. And then we moved further back, and then we come to the railway. And people there had big fires going and had tea and sausages cooking on Dixies and whatnots, and they says, right, before you go, we know you've come from Tobruk. Everybody was shouting about it. We came back to somewhere outside Alex somewhere, and I think it was Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, one of the two, because we got into this place and there was a marquee with a canteen, Naffy. We'd never seen the Naffy with donkeys. So we all queued up to get the beer, and the officers were taking their pips off because they were detachable off the thing. They're taking them off and getting in the queue because they couldn't get any at their place. So they were getting in the queue with us and getting crates of beer. And what a night that was, in the dark.
Just before we leave Tobruk, I didn't get you asked about the overall health of the battalion. Were you healthy in Tobruk?
Yes, as far as I know.